The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and this episode falls squarely into the special category. Not only will we be talking about one of the topics that I'm very interested in, this is also the first in a two-episode Fun Drive series. If you're a regular listener, you've heard me talk glowingly about CJSR, the radio station that we do our live broadcast on. From there, the show is rebroadcast on 21 other extraordinary and discerning stations. And Fun Drive is CJSR's annual fundraising campaign. So you probably know what that means. Throughout the episode, I'm going to ask you to part with a bit of your hard-earned money in support of the show that asks you to call in and question everything. So today, we'll be questioning the concept of race. We'll have author Guy P. Harrison on the line to discuss his book, Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. So stay tuned for scintillating conversation and the chance to donate to what may be one of the most important causes of all, critical thinking. Because if we were all able to do that on a regular basis, well, it would be a whole different world, wouldn't it? And we'll start with speaking up. I'm here with Noah Nez, author of the blog Diary of a Native Skeptic. Welcome, Noah.
Hi, Desiree.
So why did you start the blog exactly?
I guess primarily I started the blog as a way for other Native Americans to identify with the skeptical community. I found that when I was just getting into what this whole notion of what skepticism was, I didn't really have a way to identify with a lot of the people that I was seeing. So I was just kind of trying to find another way for other people who might find themselves in the same position can find it easier to relate to some of the ideas by kind of, you know, getting past some of those initial differences that might turn people off, like not feeling part of the group or whatnot. I know sometimes when you go to a lot of skeptic gatherings or a conference or a meeting, you'll tend to have that effect where some Native Americans might see that group and not feel totally comfortable with it, approaching them or whatnot. This is just another way for people to, you know, relate the subject matter to, you know, what's relevant in their own life.
So how is your blog different than any other skeptic blog then?
What separates my blog from other blogs is the fact that I come from the Native American standpoint, and I deal with a lot of the spiritual beliefs that certain tribes might have, whether it's, you know, just the Apache tribal beliefs or the Navajo tribal beliefs. I will just focus on those things and show how they're alike, how they're different, and how it affects people culturally, you know, socially. And I haven't found anything like that that just deals with the specific cultural aspects of it.
So are there specific ideas of science and critical thought that are more applicable to First Nations people, or certain topics that you personally want to highlight for the community?
I think my main goal of the website is just to give people a better understanding of what science is, what skepticism is, what the scientific method is, and how they can apply it to their own life, and just the usefulness that people could take advantage of in order to make their lives better on tribal communities and reservations, well, wherever they might be.
So what topics have you taken on so far on the blog?
Some of the topics that I've dealt with in my blog have kind of changed over time since I first started the blog. It started out as just a way to introduce myself to the skeptical community, and kind of like I was in some sense leaving a trail of breadcrumbs if I were to ever forget how I found skepticism, and this is the path that I followed. And then I kind of changed beyond that, and I came into my own and really understood what skepticism was to me. I kind of changed gears and wanted to aim more at things that were more important to me and the things that I felt were most relevant and needed to be needed the most attention, such as the pseudoscience surrounding health, which is like, the anti-vaccination myths that are being perpetuated out there by some of the anti-vax groups.
Well, is anti-vaccination a particular concern?
Not necessarily amongst the Native American community, but I wanted people to know that these things are out there, and, I guess it was just a general way of showing people that we don't have to be fearful of these things, because there might not be this inherent or this there might not be this fear of vaccinations like the anti-vaxxers try to instill in people, but there's more of this uncertainty, this whole uncertainty of the government, of the system, the healthcare system, doctors, modern medicine, Western medicine. So you have some people who are a little bit uneasy in those areas. So I guess this is just a way to reassure people and to give them information so they can reassure others as well.
Well, do you think that First Nations people have an exceptional resistance to science at all, more so than other cultures?
I don't see that in Native American culture. What I do see more of is the ability for tribal beliefs to evolve and to change with time. I think I heard something from Greg speaking the other day, Mr. Layden. He said that humans will adapt to their habitat, and that's just something that I've always seen growing up on the res, and distinguishing different family dynamics from other ones and how the roles would change. They weren't necessarily inherent or preconceived or predetermined, but more so they were. It seems to me, the way I understand evolution to work, is culture is much more of a it tells us much more about behavior than genetics does. One thing that really sticks out in my head is the immunization rates for American Indian children being 15 to 20% higher than the 77% national rate. And that's just one example of where some of the programs of optimal healthcare access provided by the Indian Health Services has actually shown that, where science isn't at a conflict with tribal beliefs or any type of superstition or anything like that.
Well, you mentioned how you started the blog out talking about how you came to skepticism. So can you tell us about that?
I guess for me, being an observant child and just questioning things and always being inquisitive and asking how things work, I think it had something to do with the way I was brought up and really being encouraged. And I was really, in some sense, rewarded for asking questions by being given an answer, and I would understand it, and then I would appreciate what I had just learned, and then I'm looking at the thing that I was asking about in a total different light. So that's kind of what I did. I just applied it to what was going on in the community, socially around me, in the relationship between me and my family. So I would see certain things such as different influences of religion. I might have one family member who would be a Catholic, and then somebody from another family who would be a Lutheran, and then another one would be a Mormon. But yet we would all still go to our tribal gatherings. We still all go to our powwows and go down to the sunrise dances, and we still have our traditional beliefs. And so I was wondering how all of those things would work together and why there wasn't more conflict. And I would see all this conflict and the rest of the world between various religions fighting with each other. And then we have this whole little petri dish of all of these different kinds of beliefs, not just, Catholicism and just Christianity, but you have the tribal belief system, which are just as different from each other as any other belief system. So just seeing that and not understanding how that worked and trying to learn more about that really started me down that road of questioning things.
How did you make the jump from thinking critically to becoming, I guess, a more active member of the skeptical community proper?
After I got out of high school and I started working for a while, I really missed that learning something new every day. And so I became motivated by this notion to just start learning things that I've always wanted to learn. I figured I had been done with school, I have a job, I'm on my own, I have time to do all the things that I wanted to do. And with my degree, what that really taught me was that I have the ability to learn different things. And this is just, I have the ability to learn. So I took that notion, and then I applied that to Einstein's theory of relativity. And I just was looking at it one day, and I was like, you know, I really want to be able to explain that. I want to know why E equals MC squared. What does that even mean? Like, I know what the E and the M and the C and the square, I know what those mean, but how do I explain it to somebody else in my own words? So that really started me down that line, and then so I started reading everything physics. And then I was like, man, I'm never going to get any of this unless I understand what science is. And so that really just, research led to more research, which led to more research, and then eventually it just became something where I had to do it. It was more or less like a fire got started, and I got in touch with actually a couple of skeptics. I would say one of your shows, the show that you did on Skepticism and Race, you had a guest on there, Laverne, and I actually had contacted her after I heard her on the show, and she was saying some things that had really, really struck a chord with me, and I really felt like, hey, that's exactly how I feel. I was like, I was so surprised there was another person out there like saying exactly what I'm feeling. So I was like, how do I get in touch with this person? Is other people like this? And so that's when I started eagerly seeking out like-minded people. I was like, hey, you know, this is...
They exist.
Yeah, they exist. How do I get in touch with you guys? What's going on? I thought I was alone. And I went through that whole thing. And, you know, we exchanged some emails, and then eventually I started learning more and more on my own, and I came more in touch with more skeptics, and they would give me more ideas. I actually wrote a letter to Rebecca Watson from the Skeptics Guide, and she responded by suggesting that I start the blog. And so I think that somewhat might have started and planted a little seed. And then so that notion was always in the back of my mind, like, hey, well, you could always start a blog. So I felt like if I can't go out and actively do things like, you know, go talk with people, go to the school, go to a hospital or whatnot, I can at least do that and start a blog and start putting some of these ideas out there.
We talk quite a bit on Skeptically Speaking about how to make science and critical thought accessible. So what would your ideas on outreach be beyond starting a blog?
I would say that podcasts, and the shows like yours are really the most effective way to reach people. Personally for me, what really got me into skepticism was listening to all the different shows that I could still learn things from and not necessarily stop from working or stop from doing whatever else I'm doing around the house or you know, going to the gym. I know a lot of people like to listen to podcasts in the gym. So just walking around, riding the train, you know, on your way to school.
So what are the biggest obstacles to communicating or educating about critical thought in the First Nations community?
I think the biggest problem that we have is pretty much just like the general problem that we have with everybody, is that people just aren't interested. And people are misinformed, they have preconceived notions, they have personal bias, they think they already know what science is. You know, a lot of people, they just turn their nose up as soon as you bring up the notion of this thing called science. It's like some people think of it like it's math or like, well, ew, it sounds like school. I think really it's just gotten a bad rap, and I think the hardest part is just being able to break past that wall and really explain what science is, because it's not an easy thing to explain and for people just to understand. It's a whole methodology. I really think that's pretty much the biggest problem, is people not finding it relevant and not finding it interesting.
On Skeptically Speaking, we talk pretty much constantly about diversity within the community. So how would you say that we could make our message more relevant to different people?
Well, I think the best way to make that message relevant is just by providing a variety of ways to come at people, just, you know, taking different strategies, whether it's the podcast or the blog, or whether it's a skeptical magazine, or whether it's a conference, or, you know, coming out to do something like a live event, just participating in any way, you know, just getting that questioning starting in people's brains, just so you can get that I guess you start that system of thought where you're constantly testing your own thoughts, your own beliefs, your own ideas.
And where can people find your blog, sir?
You can find my blog at nativeskeptic.blogspot.com.
Thanks very much for being here, Noah.
Thank you, Desiree.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we're on the line with Guy P. Harrison, author of Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. We're also in the midst of CJSR's fundraising campaign, Fund Drive. That's that special time of year when you are able to show your support for science and critical thought in an extremely tangible way, with your wallet. Guy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Happy to be with you.
Thank you. Now, Guy is a newspaper columnist. He's won several international awards, and he's also the author of Race and Reality. Welcome, Guy.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I think you do very important work, so I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to contribute in some way to what you're doing here.
That is a very good start to an interview, sir.
The only question is, should I donate some money now or after the interview? When can I give money to you guys? Because I really believe in what you're doing.
I like you. I would say wait a little while, because then people will be so enthused by your brilliant interview that they will be inspired.
Okay. All right.
So the concept of race is something that seems outwardly pretty easy to understand. Race is often related to geography. There are observable differences in physical characteristics. Therefore, one could assume that there are some other internal differences. So is any of that correct at all?
Yeah, that's one of the motivations behind this book. I said, you know, everybody, 99.9% of the people on the planet think that race is just an obvious truth. It's something nature imposed on us, and we just have to deal with it one way or the other. And so almost everyone is a race believer to some degree or another. And what's just stunning to me, and I, you know, have a hard time getting my mind around, is the fact that anthropologists have been screaming for the last 4 or 5 decades that races are not real. These are not biological categories that make any sense at all. Nature did not impose these things on us. We made them up. Now, you know, it's people, you know, look at me like I'm crazy when I say that, if they haven't taken a basic anthropology course in university.
Right.
And I have to explain, you know, it's not a denial of physical diversity. You know, yes, there is diversity. You know, we can see that with our own eyes, of course. But the way we interpret that diversity has just caused us tremendous problems. And it's almost like we've been driven mad by this concept of race. And so I'm just trying to bring some good old-fashioned skepticism and plain thinking to this topic. And I'm trying to transfer this information from the anthropology people out to the general public so that we can start being a little more sensible in how we view our own species.
Well, then help us out here. What is race? Let's ask a huge question right at the start.
Yeah. It depends on who you ask and what their agenda is as to what kind of answer you're going to get. But race, the reality of race is that races are cultural categories that humans have constructed for centuries to sometimes... With a very upfront objective, for a profit or some purpose. But usually, it's just something that just kind of worked its way out by the whims of culture and just came to be. It was that guy looks different from that guy, so they must be in different groups. Let's call them races, you know. You stand a dark-skinned African next to a light-skinned European, and they look so different. So, you know, it's human nature to say, well, let's make sense of what we're seeing and let's put them in different categories. Now, the problem is, traits like skin color, nose dimensions, hair type, all that kind of stuff, turns out to be very superficial and very misleading. And we just can't categorize people based on those things because, you know, today there are 7 billion of us around the world, and we do not sort out into 4 or 5 little specific categories that make any kind of sense whatsoever, because we are all Africans originally, okay, based on the best evidence we have now. We all trace back to ancestors in Africa. And in the last 50,000, 100,000 years, whatever, we've been traveling the world, migrating everywhere, mixing our genes, mating every chance we could. You know, every opportunity that arose, we always mate. And we're just this jumbled mix match of humanity. And we're really too closely related. We're too young a species. It just doesn't work. There are no real divisions between us that make any kind of sense in a logical, consistent manner. And that's why races don't work.
Well, you say in your book that humans haven't always seen race in the way that we do now. Can you explain that?
Well, there's different angles on that. I mean, we didn't see race when we were all living in Africa, probably. I mean, but we've always seen division. I think that's just some human nature thing we have. We've always clung to family, to tribe, to clan, you know, to nations, to kingdoms, to empires, to countries. We always seem to have this thing. We're basically you know, chimps who wear pants. So I think we have this hang up with, you know, our territory and our ranking, our social ranking. All these things play in to this mess called race. And the thing is, what happened with race really took off 300 years ago, 400 years ago, when we got, you know, our ships started really moving around the oceans, and we started capturing people for slaves, and we started trading with people. And we would, you know, some seamen from Europe would travel, you know, 1,000 miles down a coast, and then hit a place on the shore somewhere, and they would encounter some people that looked just absolutely bizarre to them. You know, they might be Fijians or something, and they're like, "Wow, you know, these are it's like visiting another planet and seeing aliens to them." You know, but and they would look at them. You know, even today, people in Fiji. A lot of people, I've been to Fiji and Papua New Guinea, and it fascinates me, just for a quick example, is how I could take a few Fijians, indigenous Fijians, and if I dress them in a neutral way, I could place them next to some Africans, and people would swear they're in the same race. But genetically, the reality of their ancestry is they're far, far apart genetically. They're very distant. You know, Nature, the journal Nature, had a great article several months ago. It was about the mapping of the first sub-Saharan African genomes. And it gave an example of two of the tribal Bushmen. Their DNA, their genomes that were sequenced. The scientists found out that these guys who lived practically within walking distance of each other their whole lives, turns out that they had more genetic distance between them. They were less related to each other than any one of them was to a typical white European or a typical Japanese Asian or Chinese Asian. And that reveals how absurd racial categories are, because anybody, any race believer, would look at two African, sub-Saharan African, Southern African Bushmen and say, well, they belong in a race, they're black, and the European belongs in a race and the Asian. But in fact, you'd have to put, if you're going by genetics, you're going by kinship and all, you'd have to put the two Bushmen in separate races, you know? And same with East African versus Western African, very different. Many Ethiopians tend to be more closely related to so-called white Europeans than they would be to West Africans, you know, but yet we call them black people, you know, like one big specific biological category that makes sense, but it really doesn't.
Well, are you saying then that race is solely a social construct?
Yeah. Culture masquerading as it's culture masquerading as biology. Let me get that straight. Yeah, absolutely. Because the fact is, there's really nothing to race. Okay, because if you see, as our genetic science improves, we know more and more about our DNA, our ancestry. We're learning more every day. So some people saw that as, you know, finally we're going to confirm race and tell these anthropologists they were wrong all along. But that's not going to happen, because the best you could ever do maybe is come up with thousands, maybe millions of races, okay? And even that wouldn't work. I mean, because even at the family level, you blend into another family. The cousins, we end up sharing cousins eventually, you know, and not that far down the line anyway. But so, yeah, in no kind of scientific sense does race make sense. Now, some scientists will argue with that. Okay, it's kind of...
Oh, yeah, I have a list.
Yeah, go ahead.
No. Actually, let's do this. We're here with Guy P. Harrison, author of Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. If you have a question, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Now, those of you wonderful people who want to donate, you can donate online at cjsr.com. Click the link to the pledge page and make sure that in the show donated to field, you do type skeptically speaking, because your donations are not only vital financially, they help us justify our existence, really. So we were talking about arguments. Now, people definitely do have many, many arguments for there being a biological basis to race. So if you could just tell us about some of their arguments first.
Yeah, sure. First of all, let's be real clear before we get too far down this road that this issue of do biological race categories exist or not, it's not about racism or morality. It's not liberal versus conservative. It's about reality. It's about scientific reality. Okay, so that's really important because although, yes, I'm opposed to racism, I think racism is not cool, but that's not why I would write a book quoting all these scientists and explaining and giving examples after example why races don't make sense, okay? You know, for example, I think that sexism is a bad thing. I think women should be given all opportunities men are given. I think they should be treated fairly. But I would not write a book saying there's no such thing as the female gender. You know what I mean?
Right.
It doesn't make sense. So this is really important to understand. This is not just an argument against racism. It's not a liberal thing. It's about what is real. That's why it's so important, I feel, because we really should have an honest, true, realistic grasp on our own species. And unfortunately, we don't. Very few people understand the human story, the fact that we originate from Africa. We migrated around the world about 50,000 years ago. We went through these little physical adaptions in different environments, which we now magnify and give tremendous importance, which is totally unjustified. Okay, that's what it's all about. Desiree, I have a couple of examples, if you want me to give you real quick, that kind of help people see why so many scientists say races aren't real. Do you want me to do that?
Please do.
Yeah. Imagine a typical thing you will hear a lot is a person will imagine, say, a three-person lineup in their head. They'll have a dark-skinned African, a white-skinned European, and, say, a typical Chinese person, all right? And they imagine those three people, and that's the argument. It's amazing. I've talked to this. I've given lectures on this subject, and people almost always bring this up. They say, well, if I put three people like that side by side, you can just look and tell they're different. You can see. You know, it's obvious. A child could categorize them properly. So clearly something biological is there, right? You say, well, not really. And here's why. It's because the human species cannot be fairly represented by a three-person lineup. That's not fair. It's a fake example. It's a manipulated demonstration to prove races are real. And it's not honest. Because if I took that three-person lineup and then I inserted the hundreds of millions of people who are just as human as those three guys, and I insert them in between the African and the European and in between the European and the Asian, and if you had to look at all humanity lined up in front of you and say we even line them up from darkest to lightest or whatever, or from thick hair to thin wavy hair or whatever, you know, any way you want to do it, you and I, Desiree, could walk up and down that line for 1,000 years, and we would never find a naturally occurring division, a border, a canyon that would split one race from another. We would never see where does the black race end and where does the white race begin. We would never find that point. And what we'd have to do eventually is just give up and just make up a border and say, okay, here, you guys back there are all black, and you guys, this forward are all white. It would just be a made-up division, and that's what races are, made-up divisions. And to illustrate that, imagine if I took a 7-foot man, okay, somebody out of the NBA, and I stood him next to a little 5-foot guy, and I said, look at that. Look at that. Clearly, the human species is made up of two races, the tall race and the short race. Look at those guys. Now, we would laugh at that instantly because we know better. We know that, well, wait a minute, there's like an infinite variety of heights in between the 7-footer and the 5-footer. So that's stupid. It doesn't make sense. Well, it's the same thing with race when you try to categorize people by these superficial traits. And if you even do it by continent of origin, you're making up rules again, because the continent of origin for all of us is Africa. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say, well, yes, but he traces his ancestry to South America and she traces her ancestry to Asia. Therefore, they're different races. Well, keep going and they both end up in Africa. You know, we all do.
Speaking evolutionarily, how about the idea that there are geographically adaptive characteristics of race? Darker skins, sunnier climates, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely there are. But these are recent trivial things that don't really – I mean, so what? You know, okay, great. These guys have darker skin than these guys. Okay, so what? They were in a sunnier environment and they needed darker skin to protect them from the sun. Big deal. What's the point? It makes no sense to categorize people based on that, especially when you have people who have the same skin color who are in a completely different part of the world and their ancestry is not similar at all compared to another group. You know, the darkest people I've ever seen in my life, guess where they were? I've been to Africa. It wasn't Africa. You know, the darkest skinned people I've ever seen was Papua New Guinea. Place called Bougainville. I mean, absolute. I mean, just unbelievably dark skin. This one sort of subpopulation within that country is just very dark skin. And I, you know, if you took one of those people to America or maybe Canada or Western Europe, everybody would, you know, call them black and want to lump them into the race with black Africans. But it's absurd. You know, according to their actual ancestry and genetic history, it wouldn't really be logical.
Okay, now I'm going to bring this up right now before we get a call or an email about it, because we've talked about it multiple times on this show. The idea that there are differences in IQ between the races. So where does that claim come from, first of all?
There's a long history to it, and if I encourage people, even if you don't get a hold of my book and read the chapter on race and IQ, race and intelligence, I encourage everyone to do a little research about IQ tests, intelligence tests, and the concept of intelligence, because it's absolutely fascinating, and it shocked me to think how I've been touched by this, you know, when I took the SAT exam before, you know, university, that kind of thing, because all of these sort of tests, they trace their origins back to only about 100 years ago, when these guys in America, these psychologists, were looking for some way to make themselves relevant, and they figured out a way, well, we can measure intelligence, and they sold it to the American military as a way to weed out incompetent soldiers and figure out who should be officers and that kind of stuff. And it just got picked up into the educational system, and it's just absolutely stunning when you look back at the roots of this thing. And people at the time criticized it in ways that we still aren't hearing. I mean, it's just the history of this is absolutely fascinating. I guarantee anybody who looks into this will be blown away. You know, and by the way, nobody can even define intelligence today. Okay, in 2010, that is still a mystery as to what exactly intelligence is. Nobody can yet agree on a definition to it. So we're measuring it, and we're steering people in different directions and lives based on these intelligence tests. But yet we don't really know what exactly we're doing. And I gave examples of intelligence tests that were given, you know, over the years, and they ask questions that are just absurd. They're clearly testing knowledge and exposure to certain things within a specific culture. I mean, it's crazy. It's like, you know, asking rural African kids to draw a tennis court.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, it's just insane stuff. And you have to wonder about the intelligence of the people who believed in this, because – I could go on forever about
this. Well, actually, you bring up a really good stat in your book that I found interesting. You made the observation that in the U.S., the average IQ for the entire population rose 18 points from 1947 to 2002. So that would imply that even intelligence is environmental in some way.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many factors, and the scientists are still sorting this out. And we're just learning now that the whole nature-nurture debate is even more interesting than we ever thought, because it turns out things that your mother does, eats, you know, her lifestyle, things that impact her health, things that happen to you in the womb, okay, can affect you in profound ways. Things that happen to you in the first 10 years of your life, if you don't eat right, if you're not exposed to certain stimulations, if you're not loved, all these things have a huge impact on your intellectual development. And so it is ridiculous. It is criminal, in my view, for someone to test a 13-year-old or a 15-year-old, give them a test, okay, and then say, well, you got a 79. Sorry, it's off to lay bricks for you. And then somebody else gets a 100, and they say, okay, off to college for you. I mean, that's crazy to do that and then draw conclusions based on their genetics, their something called race, their racial ancestry and limitations. It's crazy because, yes, there are groups in countries, many countries, most countries have subpopulations that are treated unfairly, have been historically. They don't have the same opportunities. They have problems, some of them self-inflicted, some of them inflicted on them by governments, by the larger majority of people. But these things, you know, we don't all start at the same starting line.
Right.
That is an absolute fact. We don't. And some people start off behind the starting line and still do better. Okay? It's such a complex maze, the route to fulfilling intellectual potential. You just never know. You never know. You know, people say, my gosh, you know, this scientist is just so brilliant. He was a born genius. Well, no. How do you know that? No. He might have been a lot smarter had he eaten better as a child, had he been breastfed or something. You know, you just
right.
don't know. You can't measure potential because you don't know what it is. And the whole idea of measuring intelligence is very, very questionable. Okay, yeah, you can measure ability. Like, you can make predictions about people. You can say, well, this woman scores high on a test, this guy scores low on a test, let's let her in our college and not him. That can make sense. I'm not denying that, because it shows that she has a certain skill level, capability. She has got knowledge. She's been studying in high school. She's ready for it. He's not. Okay, fine. But you cannot draw conclusions about gender, race, or even potential, because maybe that guy just wasn't trying hard in high school. Maybe he's actually smarter than her. Who knows? You know? So it's absurd for anyone to draw any kind of conclusions about racial mental inferiority based on any IQ test. I mean, it's crazy. And racist, there are racist scientists who actually publish books, and they show national IQ averages around the world. And they'll, you know, they have, I give an example in my book. Kenya is listed as something like 73, I believe, something like that, for
72.
National National IQ average. Okay. And racists will point to that and say, well, look, I mean, you know, no wonder Kenya's not producing Nobel Prize winners in physics every year. I mean, look, they just, you know, it's their race. It's a race problem. You know, that's ridiculous. An IQ that low, according to experts in mental health, they will tell you that is borderline mentally retarded. You know, if that was the truth, if that was really some kind of accurate measure of Kenya's mental power, that would mean it's basically a country of, you know, half mentally retarded people. And I've been to Kenya. I met many Kenyans. Believe me, there is a light behind their eyes. They're bright people. They're very smart. Okay. But they're being tested on tests.
Right.
Drawn up by people who are not Kenyans, probably, and who are not testing them on things that they know. I interviewed a psychologist in my book who spent time with a tribe in the Amazon rainforest, and he joked about it, saying that, you know, if they tested me when I was fumbling through all their daily chores, their simple tasks, the way I could barely do it, he says they would have labeled me, you know, mentally, you know, deficient. I would have been mentally retarded on any kind of test they gave me. And if you take one of them to Harvard and test them, they would probably fail a test. You know, it's just you have to keep in mind the whole cultural ramifications and implications in these things.
Well, actually, you do an entire chapter on race-based medicine as well.
Yeah, very important subject. Going to be much more important in the coming years.
But let's just clarify for people. There are certain illnesses and diseases that different races are more prone to, correct?
No.
That's why I like to clarify.
Everybody thinks that's true, but it's not. You know why? Because races aren't real biological categories. So the second you say this biological problem can be described in racial terms, you've immediately made a mistake right there. You're going to have problems. I'll give you a real quick example. In the book, I talk about sickle cell, the sickle cell trait, which is an evolutionary adaptation people developed over thousands of years who were exposed to the malaria virus. It's a way to fight against the malaria virus. Unfortunately, as a side effect of also making you sick and causing you problems and all. So it's like a trade-off thing. Now, in America, and I would guess Canada as well, it's thought of as a black disease because American blacks have, you know, they tend to have a high frequency of this sickle cell trait because they originally came from Africa, or a lot of their ancestry is from Africa, which had this terrible problem with malaria, okay? So it's thought of as a black disease. Well, it's not. That's ridiculous. The highest rates of sickle cell trait in the world are around the Mediterranean, people that you or I would describe as white if we had to give them a racial label, okay? An example I give in my book, a real-world example. A kid was brought into an emergency room, severe abdominal pain, okay, a kid who would be described as white. The doctors, they were frustrated. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. They just couldn't make sense of it. Finally, they concluded it must be his appendix. We're going to have to cut him open. Fortunately, just before they sliced this little boy open unnecessarily, somebody did some tests, and they figured out, whoa, he's got sickle cell, you know. And it turns out the kid probably had Greek heritage, okay. That's a typical example right there. I mean, you just can be so misled when you believe in race as this pure, finite, specific biological category that we should be paying so much attention to. It can mislead us. And that's why race-based medicine is a bad idea, because it would be too sloppy. It would mislead doctors and patients about what they need, what they don't need, and it would leave people out of it would exclude some people from medication they should be taking. You know, the doctors won't think to recommend it because they think, well, they're not in that race. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. And there's right now, there are hundreds of race-based medicines in the pipeline, and pharmaceutical companies are coming out with them. And a lot of scientists are screaming right now, saying, no, this is going to be a mistake. We shouldn't do this. But the companies want to do it because it's really – it's a great
marketing angle.
It's a good way to make money because you can say, hey, you know, it's more specific to you. You can get the white guy drug or the black guy drug, and it'll fix you right up, you know. I guess it would appeal to people because they feel it's more personal, I guess. But the problem is, it's, you know, my advice is just hold on and wait, because pretty soon we'll all be able to get individualized medicine, and that's what you want. You know, I don't want my doctor glancing at me and saying, oh, he's a white guy, he wants this drug, because he doesn't know my real ancestry. I may look like a white guy, but who knows? I don't even know. I have no idea who my great, 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 great grandparents were. It could have been a slave in, you know, the American South or something. I have no idea. I have no idea what's lurking around in my DNA, really, you know? So I wouldn't want a doctor to make that kind of assumption about me. I want him to look at my actual DNA and then make intelligent conclusions, not some flimsy race kind of thing.
Well, now, what do you think, Guy? Is there a biological basis to one's urge to donate to a fabulous community radio station, you think?
I think so, because it's absolute human survival. If we don't become a skeptical, clear-thinking, rational-thinking species, we're all going to die. So I say donate fast and donate frequently. Yes.
Oh, you can come on anytime you want, sir.
No, you know, honestly, all jokes aside, I mean that, though. We are sort of in a race for our survival. I mean, I just saw a report today, some guy saying that he thinks that people are becoming more superstitious.
I saw that.
Which is shocking. I mean, more, I don't know if that's true. I haven't read his research or whatever, but more than the Middle Ages? I mean, gosh, that's scary, you know? I mean, come on.
So hurry, people. You have something important to do, whether or not it's built into your genes. Donate online at cjsr.com. And again, if you have a question about race for author Guy P. Harrison, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio.
I just thought of another example for you to explain why races aren't real. Do you want to hear it?
Absolutely.
All right. Imagine we have a time machine, okay? And we're going to go out and find some white Irishman. We're going to grab him, put him in our time machine, okay? In the year 2010, we're going to put him in our time machine. We send him back to New York around, we'll say specifically 1820, okay? Now, guess what happens when our white Irishman steps out of his time machine? He's no longer white. His race changed. Isn't that amazing?
Love it.
He's still an Irishman, but at that time in American history, white Irish immigrants were not quite white. They didn't quite meet the standard, okay? Eventually, they somehow earned their way into that coveted club, I guess. But they, at that time, you know, the point is, your race could possibly change just by traveling in time. And even a more realistic example, I lived in the Caribbean. You know, now I've just moved to California, by the way, but I lived in the Caribbean for 20 years, okay? And I had many friends in the Caribbean who are not black, okay? They do not consider themselves black, and within the context of their specific culture, they're not black. They're not called black. But if you put any one of them on an airplane, fly them to Alabama or Mississippi or somewhere in the United States, by the time they left that airport, they would be black, okay? Because they're in a different culture, different race rules. Same thing with Brazil. You can fly some black people in America or Canada, people who are black there, fly them to Brazil. When they get to Brazil, they won't be black anymore. They'll be another race, okay? Now, how is that possible? It's because race is just a cultural game. It's not based on logic or anything meaningful about our real ancestry or biological, the realities. Another example, in college, when I was in university, I dated a beautiful woman, a Haitian woman, who, get this, she could change her race just by going home. Because when she was in America, she was black. But when she flew home, she became white. And Haiti is just, a few hundred miles off the coast of America. I mean, it's not even that far away. But something magical would happen up in the clouds at 35,000 feet. You know, she would change race. Because, see, in America, they have the one-drop rule traditionally, where most people, if you have at least a little bit of detectable
right.
black African ancestry, you're considered black, okay? In Haiti, it's reversed. If you have just at least a little white European ancestry that you can observe, then you're white. So this bizarre woman could actually change her race just by flying home or flying to school. Isn't that weird?
Audience, your questions are piling up. We are going to go to break, and we'll be right back with more of Guy P. Harrison and Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we wrap up our host station's annual fund drive campaign with our first ever Skeptically Speaking retrospective. We've dug through our archives of past interviews to find all the funny, interesting, insightful moments you wanted to hear. We'll listen back to the best bits with commentary and insight from the entire Skeptically Speaking team live in the studio. And for 1 week only, we'll turn on the webcam so you can watch us laugh at our own jokes. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on the line with Guy P. Harrison discussing his new book, Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity. If you have a question, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So we have a ridiculous amount of audience questions right now. Maybe we'll just go straight to one.
If we're too young a species to really have races, variants, subspecies, etc. in the biological sense, then why the dramatic visible differences? And that's from Bytor.
Well, they're only dramatic because we say they're dramatic. I mean, once you spend a lot of time among people with these dramatic differences, they sort of drop away. That would be my gut reaction to that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, it's dramatic when you've never seen a person like that who's so different from you, or you've never spent time with people like that. It can be very dramatic, of course, but to even be with somebody who is an extreme contrast to you color-wise, for example, that really kind of fades away after months and years in friendship or, you know, working together. You kind of forget that. And the thing is, you have to keep in mind also, a lot of these physical differences we see, hair, facial features, skin color. They're magnified by the differences in the way people dress, the way people talk, the music people like, the accents they have, the food they like, the way they behave, the, you know, the kind of cars they drive, whatever. I mean, that there's so many differences, cultural differences, okay, that I think it kind of puts a magnifying lens in front of people, and we just exaggerate these differences, and all kind of things come into play psychologically as far as competition, threats, all this stuff. So if you really work hard at being honest to what you're seeing, you know, I don't think the differences are really that different. We have a lot more in common with people that, you know, even the most extreme contrast. If you find, oh my gosh, if you go, you know, get a Mongolian and put him with somebody from Norway, and, you know, if they're raised together, if they were both adopted as babies and raised by the same family somewhere on Earth, and they grew up together in the same house and had to, you know, share the same culture, all that stuff, same language, everything like that, those physical differences, I think, would be seen for what they are, and that's trivial.
And another question from the website.
I was under the impression that a DNA test could identify one's nationality. Is that not the case?
No. It can give nationality is just a made-up thing, okay? I mean, there's no, you know, you can't look at somebody's DNA and read Ireland or read Scotland. You know, that's not going to happen. What you can do, though, is you can find markers that indicate, okay, this person has some ancestry through this population that was in this region. It's kind of a vague thing. I've had my DNA analyzed by the National Genographic Project, and it's really interesting because it shows, you know, that my ancestral path kind of winds away through Europe and gets, you know, and then goes back to East Africa. It's really interesting, but it's a vague sort of thing, and I can't see how you could pin it down and say, yes, you know, Serbian, I am Serbian, or something like that, because again, we're just too fluid, too mixed. There, you know, what anybody can live in any country if you can, you know, sneak across the border or meet the immigration laws. Anybody can live anywhere. So it doesn't, your DNA's really got nothing to do with it. So I think a lot of people are being misled by these companies that are selling DNA analysis kits and stuff like that so you can know your ancestry. Because the best they can do is maybe show some waypoints along the journey, you know, that originated in Africa for all of us, which is interesting. I mean, I think, yeah, that's cool. But yeah, as far as specific countries, I'd be wary of that.
And one more question from the chat room.
Although genetically races are not real, could humans be genetically programmed to see races, a survival instinct to protect our group? And that's from Luxloy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a brilliant question, because I think we are, in a sense. We're sort of pattern-seeking creatures. I think, to survive in the jungle and all, we had to see patterns. We had to hunt and to avoid being hunted, you know, to avoid being prey. We're very visual. And I think we need to make sense of our environment quickly and competently all the time. So we're always scanning that. We've still got that in us. And so it's just a way to make your way through the world. But I think in the case of sizing up each other in the 21st century, it's just a burden we don't need, because while it may have been useful in the past, it's just not now. I mean, you can't look at someone and know what you need to know about that person. You really can't. And we tend to, you know, race belief is a shortcut to investigation and thinking, and it's just not a good shortcut because it's wrong 99% of the time.
And another question from the chat room.
Do people confuse race and culture easily? And what's the difference anyway? And that's from Kylie Sturgis.
Yes, they do. That's a brilliant question too. Wow, you have a smart audience. I like these questions. Yes, absolutely. In fact, man, I don't want to guess at the percentage, but maybe most of the time when people are talking about race, they're really talking about culture, because you know, culture is this wonderful, beautiful, ugly, spectacular, horrible, lovely, dangerous thing that we humans have, because we owe everything to culture. That's how we, you know, got free of the jungle. I mean, culture is everything to us, but it sort of drives us crazy in a lot of ways, because we think we're this, here we are, this closely related species on this little planet spinning around in space, and we're all driven mad by our cultural diversity, thinking that we're really a collection of, you know, 1,000 different species with 1,000 different agendas, you know, and we're not, and it's hurting us now. You know, problems like the environment, for example, global poverty, these things, war, a lot of times. A lot of that can be traced to the problem we have with ethnocentrism, you know, prejudice against other cultures, not really recognizing that, hey, you know, cultural relativism, it's a cool thing. You have to understand, look, if I had been born in that country, you know, with that family, then I'd be like them. I'd be eating that food, listening to that music, and probably thinking a lot like they're thinking. So maybe I need to have a little understanding and not be so quick to call them enemy. You know, we need to have more understanding that this cultural swirl, this cultural mix that is humanity, is sort of just, it's all rules we're making up. It's not imposed on us. We can change. We can overcome these cultural canyons and boundaries and borders around us, all this kind of stuff. We can step beyond it. I love, you know, having said that, I love cultural diversity. I mean, it's beautiful. I love different foods, different music, different dress. All that stuff is great. But I never let it impress me so much that I think the person wearing that dress and eating that food and worshiping those gods is fundamentally different from me as a human being. You know, never. I never see that. I never. And that's how I think it would be a better world if more people understood that we can't exaggerate culture too much.
Well,
and race is a terrible thing because race, like I said earlier, race is a cultural game masquerading as biology. And it gives what a lot of times are just cultural differences, it gives unjustified weight to this race thing because we say, well, it's biology, it's nature, you know, it's really deep, it's in the blood, you know, and a lot of times it's just cultural silliness.
Now, we have about 3 minutes left. This is the last question, and I heartily apologize to everybody whose questions we couldn't get to tonight. This is from the website.
Recent research by Spee Kozloff shows that when asked to report their own race, participants were more likely to believe a smear. For example, during the presidential campaign, participants who supported McCain said there is a 56% likelihood Obama is a Muslim. But when they were asked to fill out a demographic card asking for their own race, the likelihood jumped to 77%. And even when race lacks even a tenuous connection to the question at hand, undecided participants said there is a 25% chance Obama is a socialist, a number that jumped to 62% when they considered race. What is the mechanism by which we irrationally tie race to unrelated phenomena such as political smears? And that's from Al Morrison.
That is an interesting question. I'd have to think about that in depth to really give you a good answer. But just off the cuff, I think it might have something to do with identifying yourself. You know, people, because unfortunately, we've become such a race-obsessed species that it's a part of your identity. You know, what religion are you? What race are you? What nationality are you? These questions are profound to most people. They're really important. So I think, you know, we're running out of time, but I think that has a lot to do with that we unjustifiably think race is so important that, you know, when race is brought up, we suddenly perk up a bit and think, okay, I better be on my toes here because this is part of me, you know, under the microscope or something. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Guy, you are a lovely guest. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being with you, and I hope you raise lots of money because, seriously, I mean it. Your show is fantastic. The world needs to hear you, okay? So keep up the good work.
Thank you. You can find Race and Reality, What Everyone Should Know About Our Biological Diversity, and more at guyharrison.info. And you can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks so much to everyone that donated. See you next week for our retrospective episode and continued fun drive festivities on Skeptically Speaking.
If you're listening to this episode on one of our wonderful rebroadcasting stations or on the podcast version, you may think that you've been left out of all the fun drive goodness. Not so, my friend. You can donate right now, online, by heading to this episode's post on our recently redesigned website at skepticallyspeaking.com. If you donate now, you'll be entered into the draw for next week's prizes. And even better, you'll automatically receive a timelessly stylish Skeptically Speaking button. Or you can donate while you listen to the November 5th episode, when we'll be live on camera, and you can decide if we look like we sound on air. Just visit our website at 6 p.m. Mountain Time and click the extremely large Listen Online button.
We very much appreciate all of your donations so far. Your willingness to help keep science and critical thought on the air warms our cold, rational hearts. Truly. Thanks so much for your support of Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics. And their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.